Hello everybody, it's me, Ken Bok, from A Course in Miracles Explained. And on the line, I have the one and only Kenneth Wapnick.
Oh my god, you're not starting that way, are you?
Ken, you promised to be serious.
I did actually. Okay.
So, for many of our listeners, Ken obviously needs no introduction. He is the president of the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. He has been involved with A Course in Miracles ever since its inception, and in the eyes of many, including myself, he is probably the world's leading authority on the course. And today, I actually have no plan. I don't know what to ask Ken, because I think Ken has, you've obviously, you know, written so much and spoken so much. I'm at a loss, really.
Well, how about I interview you? I'll ask you the questions. How's that? I mean, it's one Ken talking to another Ken.
Yeah, it's all the same anyway, isn't it?
People won't know the difference.
You might not fool the serious ACIM students, though.
I see. All right. Okay. So I'm supposed to shut up until you say something? Is that it?
No. I ask the questions, and then you pontificate.
I see. Okay.
Okay, but seriously, you know, I like this interview to be sort of an introduction to you.
Okay.
And I know you're a very private person, and I know you don't like to talk about yourself. But it might be useful.
But you're going to ask me questions anyway.
Yes.
Okay. You're going to pry into my personal life.
You do not have to answer anything that, you know, you don't want to answer, obviously.
Okay, I'll be serious.
No, I thought this interview would be good for people who don't know Ken Wapnick, who don't know who Ken Wapnick is, but then have obviously seen all the stuff that you produced. And, you know, there are some interviews of you, about you. There's one I just looked at before this with Ian Patrick, and that was a fantastic interview. But could you summarize your illustrious life in about a couple of minutes?
I was born in Brooklyn. And I ended up in Temecula. You want something more than that, right?
That would be good.
Okay, all right.
Please.
I was raised in a Jewish home. My parents were kind of very Jewish, and typical of many, many Jewish people, that they were more culturally identified with Judaism rather than with the religious aspects. Mm. I was sent to a yeshiva, which is like a parochial school, for 8 years, mm-hmm. first 8 grades. And my parents sent me there not so much for the Hebrew education, I think just that there was like a private school that was in the area, so that I would get a good education. Mm. I did rather well in English. I did not do well in Hebrew. I did not like it, and I didn't believe any of it. Mm. And we read the five books of Moses, the first five books of the Old Testament, 3 times in the course of the 8 years, and then the rest of the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. So I really learned it very, very well, and I was perfectly fluent in Hebrew.
Yeah.
But I just didn't believe it, and I didn't like it. It didn't make any sense to me, and my parents really didn't really care so much. Again, they were not religious people in the usual sense of the word at all. Mm. And when I graduated in the 8th grade, I went to a public high school. And I think I probably, in those years, considered myself an agnostic. I didn't really believe in God. I didn't really care about God. I had no use for religion. And actually, what became extremely important to me was music. And two things happened, actually, in my junior year in high school, which I guess I'm about 16 years old. My mother joined the classical music club. She thought it'd be nice if my brother and I, 4 years younger than I am, were exposed to classical music. Mm-hmm. And so that began like a lifelong love affair with music, and it began with Beethoven especially. And that just kind of grew over many years. And but at the same time that happened, I stumbled on a book about Freud. And I was an avid reader when I was a kid. And I had heard Freud's name, and I was looking for a book to read in the library, and this book almost really fell off the shelf into my hand. Mm-hmm. It was written by Calvin Hall, and it's called The Freudian Primer. Mm-hmm. It was basically a kind of a simplified overview of psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. And I read it, and I loved it, and I've always preferred reading primary sources than secondary sources, so I think soon after that I started reading Freud himself. Mm. I read The Interpretation, which was probably his most important book, and I was still in high school, so God knows what I understood. Mm. But I decided right then and there that I'd become a clinical psychologist and I'd get my PhD. Mm-hmm. I was not interested in becoming a psychiatrist because I had no interest in medicine or studying chemistry or biology. Mm-hmm. So I just decided right then and there that that's what I would do, and I never really wavered from that. So at this time in my life, these two strands were going on. One was kind of more external. I read as much Freud as I could. I read other psychologists, and I was very much interested in that. But at the same time I was doing that, I was developing my interest in music. Beethoven first, and then Mozart. I discovered opera when I was a freshman in high school, in college. And so there were like two tracks in my life. One I knew was internal, and one was external. And I couldn't see a way of integrating them, but at that point I didn't have to. So in college I took more literature, art, and music classes than I did psychology classes, even though I majored in psychology. Mm-hmm. I kind of went through that whole period like that. The real love of my life was music. Mm-hmm. I went to a college that was a couple of hours away from New York City, I cut classes sometimes. I go to opera, I go to Carnegie Hall. Mm-hmm. And music really was the most important part of my life.
Why? What about music? I mean, it sounds like a silly question, but music?
Actually, it's not silly. It awakened something in me that at that point I had no words for. Mm. But it really kind of awakened, I guess, what I would say would be like my spiritual self. Which, again, at that point, I would not have used words like that. Yeah. But it was something that I knew was more important and was more true than anything I was studying in psychology. I did very, very well in psychology, and I understood everything I was reading and studying, but I knew it didn't mean anything, and I knew that music did, because it pointed to something I knew was significant in people. Mm. And I believe that since I was having these kinds of inner experiences listening to this wonderful music, that experience had to be present in everyone. Mm. It couldn't just be in me. And what it did was, in a sense, it kept me spiritually honest during my early years when I had no external interest in anything religious. Mm. Or spiritual. I loved great literature too, and that also kind of fed that same, I think, I needed myself. But at the same time this was happening again, I was preparing for a normal life, to be a psychologist and get married, which I did. Mm-hmm. But I knew nothing I was doing externally could really touch this. And so its importance for me was simply that it really kind of opened up this other world, this inner world. Mm-hmm. And it was clearly the most important part of my life. Mm. Even in graduate school, I went to a school on Long Island outside New York City. I'd cut classes then too, but there'd be a great opera singer or a great conductor. Mm. And I'd go into Manhattan to attend the performance. And that was more important to me. Mm. So that really happened. Those began in high school, with all through college and all through graduate school. Mm-hmm. So how's that for openers?
It's great. It's great. Do you wanna? And then you met. Well, this is obviously fast forwarding very rapidly, and you met Bill and Helen in 1972. And was
yes, well, that, yeah, well, we skipped a lot, right? By that time, I had already my wife and I had got a divorce. I was preparing to become a monk. I had my degree. I had been working as a psychologist, and I decided that I was going to leave all that and enter a monastery. And it was shortly after that that I met Helen and Bill. The first time, they were very friendly with the Catholic priest. His name was Benedict, and actually, I was going to become a Trappist monk. That was the order that I was interested in. And this is actually an important part of the story. I began reading Thomas Merton, who was a famous Trappist monk in the Roman Catholic Church, and he wrote very, very well. And I liked his writings a lot. And he described what life was like in the monastery. And I realized that that's really what I wanted to do, just live a life totally alone with God. The fact that this was Christian made no difference to me. I had no conscious experience with Jesus or a relationship with him. There was nothing about the Catholic Church that I respected. But in order to become a Trappist monk, I had to become a Catholic. So I was working in a hospital upstate New York. And so I spoke to the chaplain there and told him what I wanted to do. And he said, well, here's a book on Catholic teaching, read it, and if you have any questions, I'll answer them, and then I'll baptize you. He didn't quite know what to do with me. Actually, he was a kind of a simple man, and I had a PhD. I was a big shot in the hospital. I just come back from a week at the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky, which was Thomas Merton's monastery.
So what were your feelings towards Jesus at this point?
I had a funny relationship with Jesus all my life. I had no conscious feelings about him, but even as a child, I would sometimes sneak a Bible into bed at night and read the New Testament. My father had taken a Gideon's Bible from a motel one time, so that there was an older New Testament in the house. And so I started reading, and I was very interested in it. And then I knew that I had to hide it because my parents wouldn't like it. I once went to a church on a Sunday morning when I was in high school, and I just wanted to go, and I just went. And, of course, I loved all the great music of Bach and Handel and Beethoven and Mozart, the church music. But it had nothing to do, I thought, with the text. It had to just do with the great music. But Jesus would surface every once in a while, and I'd read a book about him. But I was married. This is where, in the 60s, the mid-60s, and I was still in graduate school. My then wife and I went to a kind of an art exhibit in Greenwich Village, and there was a painter that we really liked. And we liked him so much, we asked him if he had any other paintings, and he invited us to his studio. And we went there one evening, and I walked in, and there was this big, big picture of Jesus. It was 4 feet by 6 feet. It was painted on wood. It was a hideous picture, actually. It was obviously a very suffering Jesus. He was not on a cross. It was just his head. But it was very, very powerful. And I bought it. And I hung it. We lived in a small apartment. And it took up a good part of the wall space of the apartment. And it was a very important painting for me. And I never thought about it. I knew that it was of Jesus. But I never thought about it, other than I wanted it, and I could always—I would feel a real presence from that painting. And when Ruth and I broke up, I moved upstate to a place in Poughkeepsie, and one of the first things I did was find a place for this painting. It was very important to me, and
so
I ended up
liked it even though. Sorry, you liked it even though you were suffering a lot.
Well, I didn't. It was something. It was Jesus. That's all I could tell you. It was a painting that was very, very powerful, obviously it was a very suffering type face. And I didn't relate to it. I didn't relate to the suffering so much. It was more that it was of Jesus. And I ended up building an altar to it without realizing. I thought I was just putting a little table underneath, and I ended up building an altar. So that was a very important thing that I owned. Not a lot to me, but I never thought about it in terms of Jesus. And when I started reading Merton, and he talked about Jesus and the monks and everything, all I could think of was God. Hmm. Now, my doctoral dissertation was on mysticism, and I did it on a Christian mystic, Saint Teresa of Avila. And I did it. I liked her very, very much, and I used her as an example because I couldn't write a thesis on Beethoven, which is what I wanted to do. I knew I'd never get that approved, and so I took Teresa's experiences as a metaphor when she talked about Jesus and talked about God as a metaphor for this inner experience that was more abstract that I could relate to from my own listening to music. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter was that for 2 years I spent a very intimate time with this Catholic saint, you know. And I never thought again, I never thought once about the fact that she was Christian, that this had to do with Jesus, even though she wrote a great deal about Jesus. Mm. So I always had this kind of funny thing with Jesus throughout my life. Mm. And this was up to and including the time that I met Helen and Bill. Mm. And even though I was planning on becoming a monk, the fact that it had to do with Jesus didn't mean anything to me. Mm. All that mattered to me was I could be alone with God. Mm. So I had a number of other kinds of searches that we don't really have time for now. But it was they a lot of them had to do with Jesus.
And I
spent a lot of time with my dreams and a lot of time thinking about what was happening inside of me, but I never put two and two together in terms of Jesus. Not at that point.
Mm, interesting.
So that leads up to when I met Helen and Bill.
Hmm. And so you alluded to some of your dreams. Looking back, would you say it was Jesus in your dreams?
Some of the dreams had to do with that. Other dreams had to do with God, or what my experience was of God. Hmm. I had an experience. One dream was of Thomas Merton talking to me, and he was talking to me in a dream about Jesus, and I could feel a tremendous sense of kind of a force going through my body. This isn't a dream. Mm-hmm. And saying, he's coming.
Wow.
And I knew when I awoke that was a very important dream, that I knew it had to do with Jesus. But again, I didn't do much with it. I just kind of set all that aside. Mm-hmm. As something that was interesting. I remembered the dream. I wrote it down. But I never allowed myself at that point to really identify with Jesus.
And how did you ever talk to your parents about this?
Not at that point, no. I didn't talk with anybody really about what was happening inside of me for a long, long time. It was very private. I wouldn't even have known how to talk about it. When I was in graduate school, we were a small class. We were like 12 people, and then ended up we were 10 people for 3 years. So we knew each other very well. And a couple of my friends would ask me, like, why did I go to art? What was it about music? And why was I reading these kind of literary books, these kind of novels that were kind of had a spiritual sense to them? I read a lot of Thomas Mann, a great German novelist, and Dr. Faust is probably his greatest book, which is kind of a retelling of the Faust legend, but with a composer. Mm. But it's a profound spiritual message in his book. He wrote a book, Joseph and His Brothers, which is kind of loosely based on the biblical Joseph, The Magic Mountain. I also read about Hermann Hesse, who's also a great German novelist.
Oh, I love
German
Hermann
novel.
Hesse, yes.
Yeah, and so he has a lot of, obviously, you know, he deals basically the same theme in every book.
Yeah, the glass bead game.
The conflict between spirit and the flesh. So people would ask me what all this was about. Some professors would ask me, and it was very hard for me to talk about it. And when I tried to, it just didn't kind of resonate with people. So I basically kept it to myself at this point. Later on, I did have to talk with my parents about what was happening, not so much inside, but what the external things that were happening.
Yeah.
They were very, very upset. with what they thought was happening to their son, the nice Jewish boy.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It ended up actually that my parents got to know Helen and Bill, especially Helen, very, very well. Helen and my mother became good friends, actually.
Because they were of the same generation, right?
Yes. Helen and Bill made a very good impression, obviously.
Yeah.
And they were both respectable people, intelligent. So
yeah.
It was an icebreaker. It made it easier for my parents then. So, but they could never really adjust to anything Christian, even though I explained to them that the courses of Christianity had nothing to do with Christianity, and that the Jesus of course has nothing to do with the Bible.
Yeah.
But it was still very, very hard for them.
Could you tell us a little bit about Helen and Bill and just kind of how you describe them?
They were very unusual people. I don't think I ever knew two people who disliked being in the world as much as they did, certainly in the years that I knew them. Bill kind of changed a little bit many years afterwards, but during the time he was in New York, he really had, both of them had a lot of trouble living. They just didn't like it. They both had very profound spiritual sides. I think Helen was probably the most unusual person I've ever met. But they didn't look like it, and they didn't act like it. And I think the most striking thing, which I've kind of mentioned other times, the thing that hit me almost from the beginning, was how much they disliked each other and projected onto each other.
Mm.
At the same time, there was a very close bond between them.
Yeah.
But they could not sit in the same room and talk without arguing.
Hmm.
Except when it came to the course. When it came to the course, all that was set aside, there was no ego involved when they were dealing with the course itself.
Yeah.
But every other thing they were involved with was awful, just awful. I mean, they projected like crazy onto each other. Helen at least knew she was projecting. Bill often didn't, which made it even more uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But they were wonderful people, and they both had a very strong spiritual side to them.
You know, Carol Howe's biography of Bill talks about Bill's past lives as Origen.
Helen once looked at Bill and saw this word written over him, Origen, over his head. At that point, neither of them knew what the word was or who Origen was.
Mm.
But Helen could often be wrong, and I think it's a mistake to make too much of that.
Yeah.
But I know Carol mentioned it in her book.
Yeah.
And it came from Helen seeing Origen over Bill.
Gotcha.
And you know, but it's true or not, I've no idea. Helen did a funny thing. Helen once looked at me and said Habakkuk. Now, Habakkuk is one of the minor Jewish prophets. There's a book of Habakkuk in the Old Testament. Now, Helen did that, said that.
Hmm.
You know, out of nowhere. Now, I'm not even sure that there was a Habakkuk, even though there's a book by his name.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, Helen could be very wrong about specific things.
Yeah.
I think there's a danger in not recognizing that.
Have you ever had memories of your past lives?
No, I'm not into that stuff. I never. I'm not saying it's not true. I do believe that there are past lives, but it never seems like an area that I should get involved with.
It
certainly seemed when I first met Helen and she met me, there's like an instant kind of rapport, and I'm sure that I was with Helen before, just like with Gloria, my wife. You know, there's a connection that goes very, very deep.
Mm.
So. I wouldn't doubt that there've been past lives, but I don't go into that, and it's never been an interest of mine. So
gotcha.
And I never asked Helen. So.
Mm.
So.
Could you tell us about now we're moving into the describing of the course proper.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a bit about those few years. 7 years, was it?
So describing, of course, Helen and Bill describing of the
mm-hmm.
course. Well, it was. I was not there then. So Helen finished. But I know a lot about it. Helen finished taking the course down in September of 1972, and I met them at the end of November of that same year. So the course was just finished at that point.
Gotcha.
I think that would be an example of what I mentioned earlier, Ken, that they fought like crazy about everything. Yeah. But when it came to the course, they worked very, very beautifully together, like a duet. And so the process of Helen taking it down was not difficult, actually. I think after she got over the initial anxiety about what was happening, the actual mechanics of it were very simple. Now, Helen told me, by the way, that she didn't really hear an inner voice. She used that term because that's what people do. What happened was she would see words in her head and write them down. So it wasn't that she literally heard a voice. It was more that she kind of saw words and wrote them down. I don't know what else I should say about it. The actual how it happened. Ken, what would you like me to talk about? Exactly how they went about doing it. Is that what you mean, or?
I guess. One thing that I wanted to kind of bring out is Helen's scribing. You know, I asked you a question about the special messages, and you said to me that Helen's the first part of the course was tainted with her ego, and as it got along, it got clearer. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Okay, that's probably the first four and a half chapters of the text is what we're speaking about. People feel or say that everything Helen, quote, heard, unquote, has to be from Jesus, and that's just, it's silly, actually. And Helen never believed that. The early scribing, which we're talking about probably, I would say, the first month or so, was more, Helen's experience was more like she and Jesus were sitting on the couch having a conversation. It was, and she wrote down everything that she quote heard. A lot of that was kind of questions and answers. Helen would hear Jesus say something, and she would write it down and then have a question about it. There was a lot of material that was geared towards helping Helen with her relationship with her husband Louis, with Bill certainly, helping build other relationships in his life. It was a lot about psychology, and all of this was really, in fact, Jesus told Helen and Bill that all this material would be taken out. Mm-hmm. And I think in part it was because, number one, it didn't really belong in the actual teaching of the course. Number two, a lot of it is just mistaken. One very clear example would be that some of the things that Helen took down had to do with sex and homosexuality. Bill was homosexual, which was a problem for Helen. And so what she wrote down was, purporting to come from Jesus, was the standard psychological view, that homosexuality was a pathology, or that it was aberrant sexual behavior. And so that's what this says. Now, you can't possibly believe Jesus would believe that or say that. And this was clearly Helen's ego. You're right. It's like another way of getting even with Bill.
Because Helen had the hearts for...
Even Jesus says that you're abnormal, not very nice. so that's there, there are things about Jung. Now, I'm not a Jungian, but I do have a great respect for him. Helen did not know Jung very well and did not like him, and neither did Bill. The standard psychoanalytic or Freudian view is that Jung was psychotic.
Wow.
And basically dismissing his work. Well, so there are some things in these original dictations which are saying things about Jung that are not quite nice, and not to say that he's psychotic, but it really showed that Jesus didn't really understand Jung. Well, I don't think it had anything to do with Jesus. I think this was Helen. Mm-hmm. So, there are lots of little examples like that, which it's a shame now that people have access to this and they don't understand it, and they don't, and they think everything again that Helen wrote down came from Jesus, and that's just not the case. Mm-hmm. Now this all changed after about a month or so, which again is probably the fourth or fifth chapters of the text, mm-hmm. when the kind of the personal stuff stopped. And Helen's experience then was like Jesus was like standing at a lectern and giving a lecture, you know, just as a college professor would. And she was writing down everything that he said. And so from that point on, the material was pretty much the way that it came. So again, Jesus had instructed both Helen and Bill to take out all that material. And it just doesn't belong.
Yeah.
So
we're talking about, you know, I guess for people who are listening now, we're talking about Jesus as if it's a fact that he wrote the course. Mm-hmm. You know, first of all, how do you know it's Jesus?
How do I know Jesus?
How do you know that?
Don't you ask me?
How do you know that?
How do you know that? How would you know that the voice Helen heard was Jesus?
Correct.
Is that the question?
Yeah, that's a question.
Well, I mean, that's what Helen said, and that's what the voice said. I mean, on the level of form, the first person clearly is identified with Jesus. Now, he doesn't say, I'm Jesus, but, you know, an example I always use, if you call up your mother, you know, you don't say, hi, this is Ken. You know, I mean, your mother knows you. So Helen knew Jesus. So it wasn't. But there are references. There are very few references to his life, but there are some references to his life. But clearly, he's the first person in Helen's experience was Jesus. So, but that was Helen's experience. You know, and I've taught this a lot over the years because people really get confused, and they get confused with form and content. Mm-hmm. And that, one of the things that I say, if actually I could tell you a cute story, once we were traveling together and we were at the airport ready to head home, and a woman walked up to Helen and said to Helen, knew who Helen was, and said, mm-hmm. How could Jesus have dictated the course he didn't know English? It was kind of a sweet question. Helen was very sweet in her response. I forget exactly what she said, but I know she was very sweet to the woman. Well, the fact of the matter is Jesus doesn't know English, and he didn't dictate the course in that way. Mm. The form of the course is all Helen. It's English speaking, it uses American idioms, it's psychological, it's very logical, it's very Platonic. Helen loved Plato. Helen loved Shakespeare, so that a lot of the course is in blank verse. Helen was a teacher, it's a curricular in its form, has mm-hmm. a text, a workbook, a manual, talks about teaching and learning all the way through. Helen was a Freudian, and as I've been saying for over 30 years, without Freud, you would not have had A Course in Miracles, mm-hmm. Because the whole psychology of the ego is very psychoanalytic, and on and on and on. So the form of it is Helen, not the content. But the form is. And so what Helen did, was able to do, and I was with her many times after the course was completed, when she did this, is she would go to that place of abstract, non-specific love in her mind, that's in everyone's mind, mm-hmm. that she identified with Jesus, mm-hmm. and that love that she experienced there then came through her.
Right.
And it came through Helen's brain, which again had all those qualities that I just mentioned, and out came A Course in Miracles. Helen did not treat the words as sacred, right. Because she part of her knew that this was not literally Jesus. As I mentioned other times in other places, there were a few times, there were very few, maybe four or five, when I was with her, when she would go to like another state. Her mind would like be devoid. Her brain, her face would be devoid of all emotion, anything, and she would talk. And it was Helen's voice, but it was not Helen. And when she kind of came down from that and came back, she would say to me, "This transcended Jesus. This had nothing to do with words. Had nothing to do with anything specific." Well, that's the side of Helen I called the priestess side in my book, and that's where the course came from. Mm. That kind of that abstract, non-specific love that is as close to heaven's love as you can get within a dream. But the form it took was what we called the Course. And since Helen identified that love with Jesus, with whom she had a very deep relationship, love, hate, Jesus then appeared to be the specific source of it. But once you get into this is like the biblical or historical Jesus and every word that Helen heard was true, you're right back into spiritual specialness, and you're right back into what, you know, has plagued Christianity for 2,100 years. Mm. That kind of specialness with Jesus, and it becomes an exclusive thing. Yeah. And it misses the whole point. It changes. You get away from the content, which is the mind, the love in one's right mind, to the form. And then the form becomes sacred, you know, and the words become sacred, and the book becomes sacred.
Well, isn't Jesus a specific type of form of the Holy Spirit as well?
Yeah, of course, says that. He's a manifestation of the Holy Spirit. You know, but the Holy Spirit, too, is an illusion, you know, the Course says at the end in the clarification of terms, because it's a form. You know, God is perfect oneness. There's no differentiation in heaven. You know, the Course says God is first in the Holy Trinity, but there's no second or third. So we're talking about the heaven being, or knowledge, state of knowledge being, a state of perfect, undifferentiated oneness. Well, there's no specificity there, so there can't be a Jesus there. So when you talk about Jesus, you talk about a symbol.
Yeah.
You know, she teaches Daniel also says. And he's a symbol for love that's not of this world. Mm-hmm. See, the problem with all this is that it gets so much into specialness. And it makes Helen special, it makes the people around her special, it makes Jesus special, it makes the Course special. And then you end up with different factions and different churches, you know, just like you had with Christianity. You know, it's no different.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it stems from this idea that it's confusing form and content, which is the hallmark of specialness, you know, that kind of confusion. Mm.
Let's get back to the story.
Okay.
Tell us a bit about where you came in and the editing of the Course.
Okay. When Helen and Bill gave me the Course, what they gave me was what we called the Hugh Lynn version. Hugh Lynn Casey was Edgar Casey's son, and mm-hmm. Helen and Bill had gone down to the ARE in Virginia Beach to meet with him. Mm-hmm. And so they prepared this, what then was like the, it was not the final, but at that point it was the final manuscript for him. Mm-hmm. And that's why we called it that. So that's what I read. And when I read it, and I got to know Helen and Bill rather quickly, and I read through it, and I said to Helen and Bill, you know, some things are not quite right. I said, you know, the capitalization is inconsistent, the punctuation is inconsistent, the paragraphing is inconsistent, some of the section and chapter titles are inconsistent. No, all of these were what Helen and Bill did. You know, I said, you know, some of the titles are wrong, and there's some material here that doesn't belong. There's some stuff on Casey, there's a little stuff on Freud that they had not taken out. All the other stuff had been taken out. And I said, it doesn't seem that way. So they agreed with me. Hmm. One of the myths that I know goes around is that I'm the one who did the editing. Nothing could be further from the truth. Anybody who knew Helen knew that nobody could get Helen to do anything that she didn't want to do, including Jesus. So I said that to Helen and Bill. We talked about it, and they agreed that the whole thing had to be gone over. Bill does not have patience for that. He's not an editor. Helen is the editor. Bill agreed that I should do that with Helen. Mm-hmm. So it took over a year, but we went through every single word. Wow. And there were times I made suggestions, but obviously if Helen agreed, it went in. If she didn't agree, it didn't go in. Mm-hmm. Most of the work had to do with those first four chapters, especially I think the first two or three chapters, mm-hmm. because so much of the personal material was taken out that there were gaps, and the version I read, some of these gaps were awkward. So we had to fix it so that it would read well. I remember saying to Helen, because we spent a lot of time on this, I remember saying to Helen, why don't you just ask Jesus to dictate these four chapters again? You know, and she said, no way. You know, once was enough. one of the things is that in the version I saw, there were 53 miracle principles. Mm-hmm. And Bill thought there should be 50. He just thought 50 was a nice number. We should have a round number. So that's what it became. Now, those three principles, the words we kept, we just incorporated them in the sections in chapter one. So I mention all this as a way to help you realize that we did not think this was sacrosanct, mm-hmm. that these words were sacred. Bill didn't feel that way. Helen certainly didn't feel that way.
Yeah.
I didn't feel that way,
yeah.
because we knew better. Mm. So that's what was done. I think the greatest challenge was the capitalization. Helen had at the beginning, Helen capitalized every word that even remotely had to do with God. She also capitalized the word separation to make it stand out like an ontological event. And so all that had to be changed. And I remember saying to Helen, I said, I'll help you develop a capitalization philosophy. I will write it down, and then let's stick to it, you know, which she agreed with. And actually, that, in the introduction to the concordance, I put those capitalization rules. But Helen would change. She had two comma philosophies. One was to have a comma practically all the way through everything. The other was to have minimal commas. And she would change that. So when she would change her philosophy, I'd have to go back and change all the commas. it was that kind of thing.
Yeah.
We laughed a lot when we did it. Helen would fall asleep while we edited. And Helen never fell asleep, except at night. So... So we laughed a lot about her defenses of her resistance, but we went through every word, and it ended up to be that was how Helen was very clear that that's how Jesus wanted it.
Yeah.
So that's what we did.
And again, to fast forward, when did you start teaching the course formally?
When did I start teaching?
Yeah, as in I guess formally is what I'm saying.
Formally. I think the first time was an accident. Gore and I were visiting a Judy Scutch in California,
mm-hmm.
and she and Bob Scutch and Witt and the other people were going to Seattle, outside of Seattle. There was a Course in Miracles conference at Crystal Mountain,
mm-hmm.
and so they were speaking, and they asked us to come along, so we came along. And I was not on the speaking schedule. And first evening, Judy and Witt were telling Helen and Bill stories and sort of how the course was written. And then Judy said that she was not the one who should be telling the stories. I should be. So she called me up on stage. And so then we kind of shared stories, et cetera. And people liked that. And they had a slot open the next day. So they asked me if I'd give a 45-minute talk on the course. Which I did, and that was actually the first time I ever publicly spoke. And I don't know, it just started from that.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw myself as a public speaker. I always saw my role as teaching teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I remember discussing that a lot with Helen. That I would there'd be people who'd be teaching the course, and I would teach them.
Mm-hmm.
But it rapidly grew to kind of what we're doing now. So that makes
a lot of sense to me, because suddenly your material is very heavy, and it tends to attract people who are very serious about it. I don't consider it mainstream, so mm-hmm. that makes a lot of sense to me. And obviously, I guess to be a teacher of the course, you have to understand it, and it's through your work mostly that a lot of teachers have a really solid understanding of what the course is saying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I know. Sorry.
So go on.
No, I guess I personally want to thank you, for being here.
Well.
And, I think on behalf of a lot of people...
Thank you.
On behalf of a lot of people, I just really want to, from the bottom of my heart, to thank you for doing the work that you do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well... That's what I do. the key thing, which I'm sure you understand very well, Ken, is that the teaching of course is really not understanding its metaphysics, which we go, you know, that's, you take that for granted, or a person can teach, of course, he or she ought to know what it says, but it's a demonstration of it.
Yeah.
And that, you know, if you teach it without really understanding it from within, then it becomes like empty words. And that's how I think often then factions start, you know, churches start, my teacher's better than your teacher, you know, that kind of thinking starts.
Mm.
But if you really become what the Course says, then that's impossible. And it's really, I guess that's what I originally thought when I had this idea of teaching teachers, you know, many, many years ago, that it was not only helping people understand what the Course said, but it's also helping them become what the Course said. That's a much different issue. But that's the crucial one.
So why do we need so many words to do that?
You don't need a lot of words at all. I think the words come in just like the words in the Course, that it becomes part of a process. You mean the amount of words in the Course?
You know, I mean, you've published God knows how many books, and the Course is half a million words, you know, so why do we need so many words?
I think because we're so resistant.
Mm.
I've always said that if people really understood the first principle of miracles, you wouldn't need anything else.
Mm.
You know, once you really understand what it means that there's no order of difficulty in miracles, then you understand the fundamental nothingness of the ego system. You understand what the correction of the Holy Spirit is, and that's it. And you don't need anything else. You know, the Course is very repetitive. And it says the same thing over and over again. But it does that because it's a process of learning. And I think what I've seen with my work, which was not how I thought of it at the beginning, but looking back on it, is that, like, if you think of the ladder of prayer that the Course talks about that I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
My work, you know, the earlier books are very simple.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like they begin like at the bottom of the ladder, and they gradually move up. You know, so I think learning is a process, and even though time is an illusion, since we believe that we are creatures of time and space, that we have to work within the illusion of time, as the Course does. And so I think that you know, all those words in the Course and all these books around that I've written, that there is, it's like part of the process.
Yeah,
it's like leading people along.
Yeah.
You know, at the end, you just say, God is, and you cease to speak, and that's it, you know.
Mm.
So my last book will be called God Is, and then you know I'm finished.
So. Wow. Is that, are you serious?
No, I don't know. I just said that.
Do you want to, I was wondering if you could say a few words about Love Does Not Condemn, I talked to you briefly about this, and it's such a scholarly book that I can't even begin to penetrate it. But do you want to talk about it and what is the main theme in it? A little bit.
Well, I can tell you a little bit about the background of it. When the Course became public, became published. I did a lot of work in the Archdiocese of New York because of our friend Father Benedict, and so I had a lot of nuns and priests as patients as well. I was giving talks then, not directly on the Course, but on spirituality and forgiveness, etc. But when the Course became public, a lot of people within the church began to attack it as being Gnostic, And I didn't know much about Gnosticism. I'd read a little bit about it, but I didn't really know much about it. But when people began calling it Gnostic and attacking it on those grounds, I said, well, at least I better know what they're talking about. So I began reading some Gnostic literature, and I became fascinated by it.
Yeah.
And so I thought of writing an article on the Course of Gnosticism and where the Course was Gnostic and where it separated from Gnosticism.
Mm-hmm.
And so the article grew into a book. and so the point of the book has, I think, a number of different purposes. One of them is to have Course students recognize that the Course falls within a very definite intellectual tradition in Western thought.
Hmm.
You know, people have this idea that, again, that, you know, that here's this woman who's an agnostic or atheist, which is not true, by the way. Helen was ever an atheist. But this woman who didn't know anything about anything, all of a sudden Jesus kind of reveals this to her, you know, writes his book. And people don't understand that. It comes within a very rich intellectual tradition, which is really derived from Plato. And Gnosticism, the highest teachings of Gnosticism are also very Platonic. And so one of the purposes of the book, again, was to place the course in this context, and then to show how it resolves a problem that has plagued everyone since the time of Plato, which is how you get from the perfect one, which is how Plotinus spoke, he was a Neoplatonist, how you get from this perfect one, I didn't talk about God as such, but one for him would be God, and then you end up with this world. You know, how did that happen? And the course is really the best way I have seen of kind of not explaining it, but describing it and giving a context within which we can understand it and relate to that and kind of move back from the world of multiplicity back to the world of the one. So it was really a way of showing how the course did this, how it really integrated and solved this Platonic problem. It was also a way of, I think, giving Gnostics back their good name, because within most religious circles, certainly traditional religious circles, Gnosticism is seen as bad guys, and that's how the Christian churches have always presented them. And to really, in a sense, kind of resurrect them and say, you know, these guys are really brilliant, and some of the higher Gnostic teachings and teachers really reflect the same kind of metaphysical vision that the course has. So it really has had multiple purposes.
How do you see the role of ACIM in the evolution
of the role of what? I'm sorry, Ken.
Huh? Sorry?
I didn't hear what you said. The role of what?
The role of A Course in Miracles.
Oh, ACIM, I'm sorry, yes, okay.
Yeah, the role of ACIM in, I guess, the evolution of Christianity on Earth.
Well, I'm not a very good prophet, so I'll start by saying that. One of the questions people ask is, you know, if the course is the teaching is so universal, why did it come within a Christian framework? And I think the answer is obvious. Christianity has not been very Christian. Nobody really knows anything about the historical Jesus, even if his name was Jesus. But there was a person who appeared, and he did have a message. And whatever that message was, has gotten really, really messed up. And so the course is a way of saying, you know, there's another way of looking at the phenomenon of Jesus, and there's another way of looking at what forgiveness is. So in a sense, it's a way to kind of cleanse the world of a lot of the errors of Christianity. Because whether you like it or not, it's a Christian world.
Yeah.
You know, and even in the East, you know, which for so long had nothing to do with Christianity, now all of a sudden, you know, you find Christians all over the place. And so basically the world has become, I think, very, very Christian. And certainly through Christian influence, one cannot deny. Mm-hmm. So I think in one sense, of course, there is an attempt to kind of, you know, get the record straight.
Yeah.
In a larger sense, I do believe that the course will be extremely helpful in changing the world,
yeah,
in terms of the world's thinking, not the world as such. But it's obvious that that's not for now. Yeah. I've always believed that our generation's purpose is to kind of lay a foundation, lowercase f, a foundation for how the course will be taught later on. But I won't be around to see it. You won't either, I don't think, Ken. I think we're talking about a long term.
Yeah.
I do think it will make a significant contribution at some point.
Mm.
But at this point, I don't think the world is ready for it at all.
So, yeah.
But I think when the world is ready for it, the course will be there. Mm. You know, in a way, that was not the case with some of the great teachers of the past, including Jesus, that the teachers have got so messed up and distorted that one doesn't know what was said. But the course is here. Whatever people may want to say about it or change it, people have access to the original books. the way it was originally published. So, but what happened in the future, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I think our job, our function now is just to preserve it with as much integrity as we can.
What are you doing for the end of the world in a week's time?
I'll probably hit the bars. And, I don't know. I think we'll be busy. I don't know. What day of the week is that? That's the 21st?
21st, yeah, 21st.
That's next Friday. I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing this Friday, so I don't know what I'll be doing. I think that's another thing that, people kind of just try to do all kinds of things into specific dates. And, one advantage of knowing that time is not linear and that the world's an illusion and that everything has already happened is that you don't take anything specific seriously. So that's my answer to your question.
Ken, thank you so much for being with us. Any kind of last things you'd like to mention to our listeners?
I think, on the one hand, A Course in Miracles is a very serious book. It's not meant to be taken seriously in the sense that it's not the book. It's not the words that are important. It's the love that inspired the words that's important. And, one of the things I emphasize so often when I teach is the most important thing, I think, if you really want to be a teacher and a student of this course, is to learn how to be kind to everyone and everything. And if you do that, even if you get the metaphysics wrong, you're doing the course. So when I say not to take the course seriously, I mean don't take it seriously as a book, as a movement, as a church, as anything other than something that will help you become more kind. And if you do that, that's how the world will end.
Thank you.
Okay, a pleasure, Ken. Good talking to you.
Likewise.
Okay, was this serious enough, by the way?
You've been listening to a podcast with me, Kenneth Bock. My work with A Course in Miracles on YouTube is entirely donation-based. If you'd like to make a donation, you can find the PayPal link in the description page of this YouTube video. For more information about myself or A Course in Miracles Explained, please visit acimexplained.com or kennethbock.com. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.